This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Did you ever consider how much DNA you leave behind each day? Maybe you shed a few hairs on the bus. You leave some saliva on a restaurant wine glass. No big deal, right? Well, what if someone came by and picked up all those samples? What could they learn about you? Heather Dewey Hagborg is an artist based here in New York, and she learned a lot about strangers from their DNA that they leave around. Using old cigarette butts, stray hairs, whatnot, she created portraits of people she never, ever met, only met them using DNA sequencing techniques that get cheaper, easier, and more sophisticated every year. And Heather's not the only one who might like to take a peek at your DNA. What about law enforcement? Today, a DNA sample found at a crime scene can be compared to millions of others in a national database. What can individuals do to protect their genetic information? Is there such a thing as genetic privacy in this age of cheap direct-to-consumer DNA testing? Artist Heather Dewey Hagborg's here to talk about it. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Hi.
Where did this idea start?
Well, it actually began as I was sitting in a therapy session, and I was staring at this print on the wall, and the print was covered with glass that had a tiny crack in it. And I noticed that there was a single hair stuck in that crack. And I sat there staring at that hair, just thinking about whose hair that might be and what I could find out about them from that little trace left behind.
And how much can you find out about someone?
Quite a lot, as it turns out. So everything from their identity, of course, figuring out who they are. Last names can be inferred from DNA. The phenotype, right, so what you look like, as well as disease risks and ancestry.
Mm-hmm. And you created portraits.
I did.
From the
so
DNA.
I made three-dimensional full-color portraits of these strangers in life size.
What do you mean three-dimensional?
So they're 3D printed. So I designed
using a
them.
3D printer.
Exactly, yes.
So how did you get the information into the printer? What kind of stuff did you feed in?
So my previous sort of research interests were in computer science, and so I actually wrote a program to take the genetic information and translate that into a parameterized model of a 3D face.
Wow. And it's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. These are amazing 3D faces. How do you know how accurate that face is?
That is a hard thing to quantify.
Yeah.
I did start with my self-portrait as my first case. I also did another radio host here in New York City, Kurt Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done a couple people who posted their genetic information online. But the piece was primarily meant as a provocation to make us think about issues of genetic privacy.
Yeah, you have a new project called Invisible, right? That's what it's designed to do, to draw attention.
Exactly. Well, Invisible is also meant as a kind of solution to the problems that I identified in Stranger Visions. So rather than just pointing out this is a problem, I wanted to propose one possible answer of many, sort mm-hmm. of a new line of research and development.
And what was that answer?
That answer is, I think, that we can start to think about how to cover up these DNA traces, how to remain anonymous in the age of DNA surveillance.
But I'm dropping it all over the place. I'm doing it on a glass and a cup, a cigarette butt, which I don't smoke, but there are other people.
Chewing gum, mm-hmm. fingernails. Yes, you're leaving things behind you all the time. And I think the first step here is just to be aware of that, to start thinking about it, to think about policy, to think about education, mm-hmm. and to begin a line of research and development. Because right now, we don't actually know how possible it is to cover up our genetic traces. Mm-hmm. We haven't done that kind of research yet. So this is the first step.
And you're a crusader in this because you actually have a product there.
I do.
To cover up the traces of DNA.
Yes.
Left behind.
Invisible is the name of the product. It consists of two sprays, erase and replace. So erase is a kind of DNA cleaning spray to get rid of DNA traces. And replace is like a cloaking spray. It'll cover it up with an alternate DNA fingerprint.
So if I have a cup of water like I have here, I take a drink.
Right.
I leave a piece of my DNA on the cup, right?
Yes.
And so you have in your hand.
Erase.
How does that work?
Reach across the table. Okay, so I spritz on the erase, and then I'd wipe it off with a cloth like this.
I see. Okay, spray and wipe so far.
That will get rid of 99.5% of your DNA. We were handing the cup here across the table. Mm-hmm. And then I can also use the replace spray. And especially on this cup, which is a paper cup, the erase spray isn't going to be as effective as it would on a hard surface. So the replace spray consists of 52 different people's DNA.
52.
52 different.
Like a deck of cards.
Including my own. Including a bunch of my own, I should say. And so then I'm going to add that spray. And that will leave behind this alternate DNA fingerprint. And you can use that on soft surfaces.
So this, you buy this product? Is this your own product this that you're selling?
I'm actually, with me today, I have a whole box full of these packages, which I'm delivering to the new museum to go on sale starting July 2nd.
So this is like spy versus spy, isn't it? You're erasing your trail.
Spies, I think, would be a good customer base.
But how can you be sure that, I mean, you touch so many things,
right?
How do you know that you're not leaving hair cells or skin cells or that kind of stuff behind?
I think it's too early to say because this hasn't been studied thoroughly. But I think awareness is a good first step. Certainly, for myself, I can say now I do notice every hair that I leave behind. Not mm-hmm. every hair. Just mm-hmm. about every hair that yeah. Every time I run my hands through my hair, I'm aware right. that I'm leaving a hair. I can pick that up. I don't leave cigarette butts behind on the occasion that I still smoke. Mm-hmm. I don't throw gum on the sidewalk. And I think if we are aware that we're touching, you know, certain surfaces in specific circumstances, because it's not as if you have to be worried every time you touch everything, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a high-profile interview, for example.
So if you're a celebrity, then you want that's your first target?
Politicians, right? Cheating spouses, people with genetic disorders, people who are already in DNA databases. You know, a lot of people think that our DNA database is composed of just so-called criminals, but actually there's a lot of people who are just arrested or suspected of crimes, people who've gotten pulled over for speeding can end up with their DNA in the database. Hmm.
But we're now moving past DNA. We're going to, like, facial recognition now. Isn't that going to make it a tougher problem to be anonymous?
I think that these things all go together. So actually, I came from a background of working with facial recognition algorithms. That's how mm-hmm. I developed Stranger Vision, was taking 3D facial recognition algorithms and repurposing them to create faces. And so I think it's a total picture. And I'm interested in all of these different aspects of surveillance. But I noticed that whereas we focus a lot on electronic surveillance, we really neglect thinking about biological surveillance. Mm-hmm.
Do you volunteer to make these 3D the 3D printed stuff for people if they want to have it done? Can they do it themselves, or you teach them how to do it, or is that a business?
So I would do a commission, certainly, as an artist. And I'm also doing a workshop, actually, in Montreal this coming fall. On this very subject, where I'll be sort of working with people hands-on to take genetic information and turn it into portraits.
Mm-hmm. All right, I want to bring in another voice to this. I want to bring in Buzz Scher. He is a law professor at the University of New Hampshire in Concord, and he studied the intersection of genetics and law enforcement. Buzz, welcome to Science Friday.
Pleasure to be here.
What do you think of all of this?
Well, we have a term in legal scholarship for Heather's project, which is awesomely cool.
Thanks.
It's just perfectly provocative at a incredibly important time. I think one of you said earlier that you know, we pay a lot of attention to electronic privacy, digital privacy. I think particularly those under 30. Think a lot about digital electronic privacy mm-hmm. and think not at all about genetic privacy when, you know, as Heather said, we're leaving these DNA droppings all over the place around the world as we make it through the day. And there are people collecting them. There's, you know, paparazzi are collecting stars' DNA. Divorce lawyers are collecting the DNA of an ex wife or ex-husband for maternity or paternity testing. You know, there are genealogists even who are tracking people around, genetic mm-hmm. genealogists who track people to figure out if they are their, you know, the last undocumented descendant of a certain person. It's really, you know, this kind of testing is changed the world of genealogy substantially.
Is all this legal? Oldest collector?
Depends. You know, to give you the good lawyer answer, it depends. Most states, not all states, have genetic privacy statutes that effectively prohibit a person from genetically testing somebody's DNA without their consent. Now, genetically, the definition of genetic testing depends. The reason these statutes were passed back, most of them back in the late 90s, early 21st century, was for was when a whole bunch of genetic anti-discrimination statutes were passed to prevent discrimination in the provision of health care based on one's genetic makeup. And they accompanied those with genetic privacy statutes. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting question, depending on what state Heather is doing her testing, whether the genetic privacy statute and the definition of genetic testing would cover what she's doing.
Did you think? Did you think about that when you were doing your?
Not when I started.
Yeah,
It didn't occur to me that there could possibly be a law against it because it just seemed so impossible to stop. Yeah. But as I started working on Stranger Visions, and actually as I came to sort of stop working on Stranger Visions, I did realize that New York State does have such a law.
but is it possible, Buzz, that New York State itself has a database?
Oh, they have several databases. They have a database for people convicted of certain crimes. It's mandatory that they give a biological sample, usually the scraping of the inside of one's cheek, a buccal swab, to the police upon conviction. And every state has that. The federal government mm-hmm. has it. It varies from state to state, whether it's just people convicted of felonies, of certain felonies, of misdemeanors. Some states, like Maryland, in a case that was before the U.S. Supreme Court last year, some states have arrestees in there, and then police departments are compiling what I call rogue databases that are not highly structured and highly regulated like these formal statutory genetic databases, which you can only use them for very limited purposes of identity. You can't do research. It's a crime to use it for any other purpose. But New York City, for example, has an offline or non-CODIS database, about 11,000 people in it. Just, you know, let's just imagine, Ira, that hypothetically you were at a very nice party last night and you left early, but it turns out the other people at the party were less reputable, got in a fight, and one person was seriously injured by someone who left the scene, and they don't know who it was. And the police go there, and they collect a whole bunch of DNA. So they contact you, and they say, Ira, we want to eliminate you as the person who left the DNA on the knife that was used to stab this person. So, you know, you would say, sure, no problem. Let me give you the DNA sample. And they swab the inside of your cheek. What they haven't told you is it's very likely in New York City that once they do that, and let's theorize that you are eliminated, they then put your sample in a database. It's not regulated. They can do with it whatever they want to. They can not only profile you at 13 locations to get a numerical sequence that represents your genetic identity for these criminal databases, but they could mine your DNA for all kinds of stuff that Heather was talking about. You know, medical predispositions, ancestry. You know, there's this kaleidoscope of identity in your DNA. And so depending on what party you go to and your interactions with the police, your DNA may already be in the New York City database.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about the DNA, I guess, database with a Buzz Scher and Heather Dewey-Hagborg, a artist and founder of the new privacy company Biogen Futures, and Buzz is a law professor at the University of New Hampshire. And you say you think this is going on in cities around the country?
I know it's going on in states around the country. Many years ago, the police chief in Erie County, where Buffalo is, said he's collecting these things. Baltimore's got a database of 3,000 homicide victims. There's a group of counties in Central Florida that is pooling this information. So some of it is, you know, these elimination, so-called elimination DNA. Yeah. Some of it is following people around who they suspect of committing a crime. This is called surreptitious harvesting. And they suspect, let's pick a name, they suspect Ira of committing a crime. They don't have enough evidence to get a search warrant to get a DNA sample from you, which is what one would think the law would require. So they follow you around and they go to the, you know, the hip coffee shop where you get your coffee every morning. You've yet to purchase any of Heather's products. You have a cup of, a macchiato latte or something like that, and you leave your cup there, and they pick the cup up, and they mine the saliva on that cup for your DNA and compare it to the crime scene sample of unknown origin. Right now, there's no court that has found that that's unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. I think it actually is unconstitutional, but that's not been the way courts have headed so far. So the police could be doing this.
Let me ask Heather, did you realize once you just looked at that little hair and the crack in the glass that you were getting to something so much deeper?
Well, I don't think I realized it at first, but it's become a dissertation for me, actually. So I'm getting pretty deeply into it now. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the DNA database issues, for me, it's that the DNA databases are just constantly growing in size and in scope. You know, we're constantly adding new kinds of crimes. What began as databases just for violent offenders have dramatically increased to include all different kinds of people. And once you're in the database, you can be tracked and you become a potential criminal, mm-hmm. right? You are then this sort of possible criminal in the database.
A target.
Exactly.
As does your family.
Right.
Familiar. Those related to you, they have a practice called, in some states, with these databases, familial searching, where they'll send a crime scene sample of unknown origin through the database, and they'll do a low stringency search, which means they say, tell us not only who matches at all 13 locations, but tell us who matches at least 8 locations and doesn't match at the other 4 or a 5. What we know then is that person who's in the database who matches at 8 didn't leave it there, but very likely someone related to them did leave it there.
All right, we have to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more with Buzz Scher and Heather Dewey-Hagborg. Our number, 844-724-8255. If you'd like to talk about this, you can also tweet us at SciFry. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about genetic surveillance. How will cheaper, more sophisticated genetic testing impact privacy and what you can do about it? Talking with Buzz Scher, law professor at the University of New Hampshire, Heather Dewey-Hagborg, artist and founder of the new privacy company Biogen Futures, who has a product that can wipe away your genetic traces. How much did you have to learn about biology to get into making this product?
Well, a good amount. So I started by taking a crash course at GenSpace, which is a community biolab in downtown Brooklyn. And the crash course was 3 weekends. And so in that class, I learned the basics of how to extract DNA and how to analyze it. And that really got me started. And from there, it was really about doing research online, reading papers and just getting engaged with the scientific research.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any demand for the spray so far?
Quite a few people actually have emailed me and are interested in purchasing it. We'll see starting July 2nd what the demand is. I'll be pretty curious to see how that pans out.
Mm-hmm. And all your research, was it expensive developing the product and learning all about that?
It's expensive for me as an artist. I think in terms of scientific research, it's probably on the less expensive end of things, but it is all sort of self-funded, a labor of love. Mm-hmm. So it's expensive for me.
Are you going to find out, do any more work on how well that the 3D image you can generate from the 3D printer using the input from the DNA, how
yes.
well that works?
Actually, I'm doing a residency this fall at the University of Connecticut where we're doing a kind of high-tech version of Stranger Vision. So the first version I did was all using sort of the older technology called PCR, polymerase chain reaction, which is very labor-intensive, very slow, and sort of didn't allow me to look at as many places on the genome as I could using this new high-tech technology.
Mm. Can you make a spray yourself if you take your own samples of saliva and someone else's and whatever, mix it together?
Absolutely.
And spray it out?
Absolutely. So you can erase your DNA traces using really any kind of cleaning spray is going to be at mm-hmm. least moderately effective at doing that. And then you can replace them. You could get your friend to spit in a cup and just leave their spit, right? You could collect cigarette butts from the street and plant them anywhere you want.
Well, rule number one of successful criminal behavior would be, you know, bring somebody else's DNA to the crime scene.
Exactly, right? And so if you have some basic molecular biology skills also, you can extract DNA from those things. And you could make your own spray. And, you know, if you use it very quickly, also, you know, you can spray it right away. The spray that I've developed also includes a preservative, which will keep the DNA stable for a long period of time.
Well, don't you think all the criminals are listening to us now and will say, hey, I've got another tool to beat the law?
I think that we're all criminals if you have enough information about us. Mm-hmm. I think we're all guilty of something. But I didn't design the spray to assist violent criminals, so I don't think it would actually be very effective in that context.
On the other hand, ironically, if your 3D printing technique works from DNA samples, that'd be highly desirable by the police to be able to, you know, create mugshots or 3D heads of some people.
Yes, and there is quite a bit of research happening in that area that I've been leveraging for that mm-hmm. project. And, you know, I just sort of pushed it to the next kind of speculative level of saying, where is this existing for what's called forensic phenotyping technology going? Where do I see that going in the next few years?
Buzz, what do you think about how do we limit for people who are afraid of, you know, being caught up in this trap? Is there anything we can really do to stop people from analyzing our DNA? Is the genie out of the bottle?
It's on its way out, but the cork is still available, for lack of a better way of putting it. In the criminal context, the surreptitious harvesting I was talking about before, you know, the Fourth Amendment should protect individuals from the police doing that. And I think most judges don't understand genetic privacy particularly well. And I think, you know, that could be used in the criminal context to limit some of this collection. I'm working on a piece right now that deals with the constitutional problems with rogue databases. Mm-hmm. So the police just can't gather that DNA from you, Ira, after the party and do with it and go beyond the limited consent that you gave them. So in the criminal context, there's some mechanisms available. Civilly, I think some of the genetic privacy statutes need to be rewritten. Mm. I think a woman named Elizabeth Joe has written a very good article about the possibility of making theft of DNA a crime. There's some problems with that, but I think it's a very good idea. And the really nice thing about Heather's project is, as she said, it provokes us to think about this. And, you know, we don't want to live in a society where, don't take this the wrong way, Heather, where mm-hmm. everybody's got to buy Heather's spray. Mm. We don't want to have to worry about where we're dropping our DNA every day. It's just not the kind of world we want to live in. I think everybody agrees on that, but nobody with... Mm. Except for a few people like Heather and a few others are really thinking about this and mm-hmm. trying to figure out ways to put the cork back in the bottle.
I have on the line a past guest we've had on Science Friday, Dr. Greg Hampicky. And welcome to Science Friday. Welcome back.
Hi. Thanks. It's great to be on. Great show. Very interesting today.
What would you like to add?
Well, I remember some early attempts to kind of cloak DNA. So some of the first buccal swabs that were attempted on prisoners, what happened is originally they were going to pluck hairs for DNA, they shaved all their hairs, then they were going to go for buccal swabs, and they super glued their lips. And of course, eventually they got the DNA. We've had people try to obscure buccal samples with putting other prisoners' semen in their mouth, for example, which was pretty easy to detect. But I think often, almost, I mean, all these times we've detected, the attempts to cover up actually leave a good trace, a good trail, and kind of make one a suspect. So I think, you know, buying DNA spray might be a good way to alert people to the fact that you might be interested in covering up your trail.
Well, you could. Is there a law against being paranoid? You know,
No. And I think there are a lot of people with OCD who, you know, are going to be buying this product. But I think the criminals are already doing things like this. We've had them, you know, they're bleaching victims, they're burning victims. We had a local criminal who was raping and collecting the sheets. And when a suspect was arrested, he was shaved almost entirely. So I think, these ideas mm-hmm. are around, but the amount of DNA we leave and the fact that you can be reconstructed by family members, for example, we don't need to actually have your DNA to have an idea of what your DNA is. I think it makes it very difficult to try to obscure this.
Mm. Well, thanks for the call.
Great project, but there are some practical issues.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I think that those are all great points, especially regarding the criminal context. And again, you know, this is not a product that's targeted at criminals. It's really more thinking about privacy advocates, activists, celebrities and politicians, people who might have specific cases where they want to get rid of their DNA in this, you know, really specific instance.
One of the interesting parts of Heather's project, particularly Stranger Visions. When I first heard about that, what I thought about was, so she's got the kind of the facial features, the facial phenotype, loosely. How much more of a person's DNA and information in a person's DNA can Heather include in that project, in the description of the person who left that cigarette butt there, before that person who left that cigarette butt there feels like Heather has taken something from them? I mean, put aside genetic privacy statutes. You know, you've stolen theoretically, I'm not saying in the legal sense, but you've stolen their likeness mm-hmm. by marketing your masks. And how much more genetic information can you add to that mask describing the person who left that, their ancestry, what continent of origin they came from, what medical predispositions they have, before a person feels like you've stolen something from them? Mm-hmm. And should the law recognize that kind of theft? I mean, it's all, you know, what judges say in the criminal context is, oh, it's out-of-body DNA, you've abandoned it, so you have no rights whatsoever in it. And I think that's one of the fundamental underpinnings of this whole conversation. Have you completely abandoned all the kaleidoscope of identity that's in every single cell you drop throughout the world every day? By it simply being outside your body? I mean, I don't think if you put it that way, anyone really agrees to that, but that's kind of the state of the law right now.
Let me go to the phones. Let's go to Lisa in Caledonia, Michigan. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there. Longtime listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
This is something I've been looking for an answer on a long time. I donate blood, and if a recipient of my blood were to leave it behind for whatever reason, and it would be analyzed, whose DNA would be in it?
That is such a good question. So there's been a lot of cases recently, actually, that have been in the news about these kind of DNA, you know, these fusions of DNA from different people that end up actually being in people's bodies. So there was a case that was in the news recently about a woman who was trying to prove that her children were her own. And her DNA testing kept showing that they weren't, even though she knew that she gave birth to these children. And so it is actually a very real concern. And not just even, I would say, I mean, one of the things I've been researching recently is also what happens to DNA that might get harvested from medical waste and from, you know, bits and pieces that are harvested from people in, mm-hmm. in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. So you,
There's a famous case out in California, Moore versus the Regents of California, a pre-DNA case, but they harvested, they did a splenectomy on Mr. Moore, and his physician, it was for his health benefits for him, and I think he had hairy cell leukemia, and his physician, aptly named Dr. Gold, contracted with a company, and they got a patent on a modified version of the cells they took out of his spleen. And Moore filed suit against Dr. Gold. And Dr. Gold made a lot of money off of this, saying, hey, I should have a piece of the pie here. That's mine. I own that, even though it was outside my body. And the California Supreme Court, this is, you know, 20-plus years ago, said, no, you don't own anything there. He should have told you he had another interest in doing the surgery rather than curing you, but you don't have any property interest in your out-of-body medical waste in the form of his removed spleen. So the law is profoundly messy in that area.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Heather Dewey Hagborg, artist and founder of the new privacy company Biogen Futures. By Schur, law professor at the University of New Hampshire. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today, and good luck on your new venture.
Thank you.